Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to the Totally Driven Entertainment Radio Network.
In the future, none of you are heroes.
You're legends.
Get driven. Stay driven.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the Bareback Facts. I do apologize for some choppiness in my voice, but today I'm getting over being a little bit sick. So today we're going to be talking about Ashurbanipal. It was one of the first predominant kings of Assyria, an ancient kingdom spoken of in the Bible for some of you more familiar with that. Nonetheless, they were considered to be the rival of many a great kingdom in the ancient period of time. The Assyrians were a predominant threat to the early Greeks. They were a huge threat to the Egyptians. And today we're going to talk about one of the reasons why that is. We're going to be talking about Ashurbanipal. He was the king of the Neo-Assyrian Empire from 668 to 627, the son of Esarhaddon, and the last strong ruler of the empire, which is usually dated between 934 and 609 BC. He's famed predominantly for amassing a significant collection of cuneiform documents for his royal palace at the city of Nineveh. The collection, known as the Library of Ashurbanipal, now in the British Museum, which also holds the famous Lion Hunt of Ashurbanipal set of Assyrian palace reliefs. Hebrew Bible, he is referred to as Assanipar, but Roman historian Justinus identifies him as Sardanapalus, although the fictional Sardanapalus is depicted as the last king of Assyria and an ineffectual, effete, and debauched character, whereas the three further kings succeeded him were in fact an educated, efficient, highly capable, and ambitious warrior king. So, let's get to the early life of Ashurbanipal. But before we do, I'd like to remind you all that here at Totally Driven Entertainment, we have a call-in number, and you guys are free to call in anytime. Call-in number is 718-508-9883. So you have questions, comments, concerns, you just want to harass me on the air, that's totally fine. I don't really care. I will enjoy it. But let's get into this thing. So Ashurbanipal was born toward the end of a 1,500-year period of Assyrian ascendancy. His father, Esarhaddon, the youngest son of Sennacherib, had become heir when the crown prince was deposed by rebels from his position as a vassal for the Empire of Babylon. Now, Esarhaddon was son not of the former king Sennacherib Kutu the Pure, known by her native name Nakia, though there are some suggestions that she may have been an Israelite or Aramaean concubine, while others point to her family origins being in northern Assyria, the northern Assyrian city of Haran specifically. The only known queen for Esarhaddon was the queen Ashurhamat, who died in 672 BC. Nonetheless, Ashurbanipal grew up in the small palace called Bit Riduti, which means the House of Succession, built by his grandfather when he was crown prince in the northern quadrant of Nineveh. In the year 694, Sennacherib had completed the palace without rival at the southwest corner of the Acropolis, obliterating most of the older structures that had been in that area. Now, before we continue on, let's just take a look at some of these names. I mean, the palace without rival. How badass are these names for the things that they build? I mean, if you're going to build a palace, name it the Palace Without Rival. I mean, really? Come on. Now, the House of Succession had become the palace of Esarhaddon, the crown prince. And in this house, young Ashurbanipal's grandfather, was assassinated by uncles identified only from biblical accounts as Adramelech, Abimelech, and Sherezer. Now, from this conspiracy, Esarhaddon had emerged as king in 681 BC. He proceeded to rebuild as his residence, Bit Marsharta, Weapons House, or the House of Succession, was left to his mother and the younger children. Ashur Banipal was included amongst them. Excuse me. Now, the names of five brothers and one sister are known. His brother, Sin-Iddin Apli, the intended crown prince, would die prior to 672 BC, and not having expected to become heir to the throne, Ashur Banipal was trained in scholarly pursuits as well as the usual horsemanship, hunting, chariotry, soldiery, craftsmanship, and royal decorum. Now, notice that I mentioned chariotry. For those of you unfamiliar with chariotry, in the ancient world, the ability to steer a chariot made you a formidable force on the battlefield. Chariots were one of the notable arms of war for the Assyrian Empire. It made them extremely successful. A chariot is much like a small wagon, but it is pulled by a horse. And unlike a wagon, however, it's generally much smaller, much sleeker, tending to only really be able to carry two men, two warriors, one man to steer, one man to fight on the back of a chariot. This allowed them to fire arrows at large, at a faster rate, also allowed them to attack foot soldiers with higher maneuverability. So being able to control a chariot made you a formidable force on the battlefield, and Ashur Banipal, being a man born to the nobility, would be expected to know how, not only know how to do this, but also be among the best at it, which of course he was in his autobiographical statement. Sorry, got choked up there. Ashur Banipal specified his youthful scholarly pursuits as having included oil divination, mathematics, reading, and writing. He was able to read and write in Sumerian, Akkadian, and Aramaic. So these are three languages that exist during the time, three ancient languages. Aramaic is the founding stone for Hebrew. Akkadian is a language that's now dead. We don't use it anymore. Aramaic is pretty much dead unless you're using it for translation. And Sumerian is one of the languages, a cuneiform language that we no longer use. But it's thought to be the precursor to several languages, among them various forms of Farsi, Persian, Arabic, and the like. So, in his youth, Ashur Banipal, very learned young man. Now, he would succeed his father, who had reigned from 681 to 669 BC, as king of Assyria and ruler of the Assyrian Empire in 668. Ashur-Banipal had prepared for the accession of his son by imposing a vassal treaty upon his Persian, Midian, and Parthian subjects. These were all nearby kingdoms who basically now had to bend to his will, whether they wanted to or not. This is going to crop up later and be a problem that our friend Ashur-Banipal is going to solve. Now, ensuring that they accepted Ashur-Banipal's dominance in advance, he imposed this treaty. He had also rebuilt Babylon and set up another of his sons, Shamash-Shum-Ukin, to rule there, subject to his brother Ashur-Banipal in Nineveh. So this is also going to prove to be a bit of a problem. His father sets up his brother with his own little kingdom and says, here, you're in charge of Babylon. This is for you. I'm going to rebuild this empire, which I destroyed. I'm going to give it to you. But you still got to do what your older brother says, okay? All right. As we all know, brothers don't always get along, so we can tell that this is probably not going to go very well. Now, Ashur-Banipal succeeded Ashur-Banipal in 668 BCE and ordered a great coronation festival for his brother's ascension to the throne of Babylon. So Ashur-Banipal, nice guy at the beginning here, is going to order a great coronation festival for his younger brother and his ascension to the throne. In his own inscriptions, he writes how Shamash-Shum-Ukin was welcomed to Babylon amidst rejoicing as the statue of the great god Marduk, taken from Babylon in 689 BC by Sennacherib, who had sacked the city. So the Assyrians, pretty well known for sacking cities. They're big fans of that. Elevated Babylon to its former status as a great city and refers to Shamash-Shum-Ukin as my favorite brother. Once he saw that Babylon and the southern territories of his empire were now secure, he led his army south toward Egypt to finish what his father had begun. Now, prior to his father handing over the reins to his son, Ashur-Banipal's father Ershardan, had been at war with the Egyptians. The Egyptians were also an expanding power during this time. They too fought from chariot back, and they were quite successful in their expansions. They controlled a great deal of territory, and this was territory that Ashurbanipal's father and Ashurbanipal wanted to secure. Now, Ershardan had conquered Pharaoh Tirhakah, but had not killed him. Now, Tirhakah's family had been brought back as captives to Nineveh and remained there, but he and his extended family had fled south to Nubia. Now, the Nubians also had a bit of a strong kingdom. They were rivals to the upper Egyptian kingdoms, but they saw the Assyrians as a threat, shelter them. When Ashurbanipal invades Egypt in 667 BCE, he drives his army south as far as Thebes, sacking every rebel city in his path. The only ruler spared was the king who had remained loyal to Assyria, King Necho of the city of Sais. Necho's son, Sametichus, had been brought back to Nineveh by Ashurbanipal for re-education. Because once you capture a city and you capture some of his kids, you've got to make sure that they know that you're the good guy. Now, his re-education was to take place in the Assyrian ways and beliefs, and he would now then be returned to his father to rule with him. Now freshly educated in the culture of the Assyrians and their laws, it was expected of him to go back and convey those messages to his papa. Now, Ashurbanipal divided the territories of Egypt between these two kings, and then in the belief that Egypt was secure, he returned to Assyria to deal with problems with a nearby kingdom of Elam. Tirhakah's nephew in Nubia, however, a young man named Tatanami, recognized Egypt's vulnerability under the new rule of the joint kings and decided to seize the opportunity to be a pain in the ass. Tatanami marched on Egypt and took each city on his route with minimal effort. At the capital of Memphis, he engaged with the Egyptian Assyrian forces under the command of King Necho. Now, if we flash back, we recognize that King Necho is one of the only guys that actually stayed loyal to Ashurbanipal, and thus he is spared. Now, although his son Sametichus was able to successfully repel the Nubian army, Necho, however, is not so lucky. He is killed in the battle. The Egyptians preferred the rule of the Nubians over that of the Assyrians, however, and Sametichus is driven into hiding as a consequence because the Egyptians also decide it's time to rebel. So, in 666 BCE, word of the rebellion reached Nineveh, and Ashurbanipal returned to the land at the head of his troops and again crushed the rebels. Now, once news reaches Ashurbanipal, he's pretty pissed off. The stronghold at Thebes is sacked, and Tatanami abandoned his campaign and flees to Nubia. Ashurbanipal makes Sametichus full pharaoh of Egypt, equipped with Assyrian garrison stationed at strategic points, and then again returned to Assyria in 665 BC. Between 665 and 657, he puts down a rebellion in Tyre, fights the Elamites, leads his army through Anatolia to reconquer the people of Tabal. If you're not sure where Anatolia is, it's basically what we would now refer to as modern-day Turkey, and subdued the kingdom of Urartu, which had again risen to threaten Assyrian interests. Now, while he was engaged in these campaigns, Egypt was slowly slipping away from his grasp. Tetius is not content to rule as an Assyrian puppet. And as a consequence, he's going to make the same mistake that everybody else has been making this entire time when dealing with Ashurbanipal. Early on, as you can see, Ashurbanipal seems like a pretty even-handed guy. He conquers a place, he puts somebody in charge, and all they got to do is do what he says, and things are gravy. They don't, he comes back, and he murders them, and then he puts somebody else in power. Seems like a pretty even-handed dealing here. Do what I say, and I don't have to come back down here and kill people. If you don't do what I say, I have to come back down here and kill people. Unfortunately, Sametichus is not content to rule and be pharaoh of a vast kingdom underneath the control of the Assyrians, because apparently that's just not good enough, and he begins to assert his independence by making deals with various Egyptian governors and courting the favor of King Gyges, the king of Lydia, in Anatolia. Now, in 653 BC, with the help of the Lydians, he is able to drive the Assyrian troops out of Egypt and establish his new capital at the city of Sais. Although news of this revolt is brought to Ashurbanipal's attention, there's no record that he returns to Egypt to really do anything about it this time. His old enemy Elam was causing problems closer to home, and he decided that that was the priority at the present time. Now, by the year, tired also of being Ashurbanipal's puppet king. Inscriptions from Babylon indicate that Ashurbanipal had been dictating his brother's decrees and managing his affairs because that's what he does. He's in control. Other inscriptions indicate that Shamas sent secret envoys to the king of Elam asking for support in throwing off the Assyrian yoke. But Ashurbanipal, it seems, knew nothing of his brother's schemes and was only aware that the armies of Elam were mobilizing for an assault on Babylon, and taking the offensive, he marched his army to Elam and attacked. He defeats the Elamites and sacks all their cities. And according to his inscription, he killed the Elamite king Tumman and his son with his own sword. With the encouragement of Assur, I killed them. I cut off their heads in front of each other. He then brought the heads back to Nineveh, where he hung them in his garden as a decoration, proving once again that pissing off Ashurbanipal is probably not a good idea. Since Ashurbanipal did not know his brother had invited the Elamites to Babylon, Shamas continued with his rule, and Ashurbanipal continued to dictate it. Even if he had known his brother was complicit in their invasion, he probably would not have had time to deal with the problem, because a coalition of the Medes, Persians, and Sumerians, not to be confused with the Sumerians, this is the Cimmerians, marched on Nineveh in the same year and brought their forces within reach of the walls. Ashurbanipal called upon his extremely powerful Scythian allies. And if you're not familiar with the Scythians, they're a pretty tough bunch. Upon them, they were known at this time for their skill as cavalry, and defeated the coalition, killing the king of the Medes, Phoreortis. Now, for those of you unfamiliar with the Scythians, they are a people that come from basically what would be the bottom end of Russia, going into Turkey and Anatolia. And they're pretty well known for being a tough bunch. Some of them are known to have settled near the Volga River, and they're later associated with many roving bands of Vikings and other groups. It's thought that they might be the precursors to some of those roving bands of peoples. Now, his brother, Shamash, was no more pleased than he had been before at being his brother's puppet. And in 652, he decides that it's enough with the games. He's going to openly rebel. So he begins taking Assyrian villages and outposts and claiming them in the name of Babylon. Now, when Ashurbanipal responds by marching his army to the region, Shamash retreats behind the walls of Babylon, where he is besieged by the Assyrian forces for the next 4 years. Inscriptions from the time relate what the defenders of Babylon endured behind the walls. They ate the flesh of their sons and daughters because of starvation. When the city fell, those who had survived so long were cut down by the Assyrian soldiers. And Ashurbanipal writes, "The rest of those living I destroyed, and their carved up bodies I fed to dogs, to pigs, to wolves, to eagles, to birds of the heavens, to fishes of the deep." Shamash sets himself on fire in his palace in order to escape capture. You'd think he would just run, but apparently that's out the door. Ashurbanipal then sets an Assyrian government official named Kandalu on the throne of Babylon. Now, before we progress further, some of the reasons why you might think, well, why didn't that guy just run, like I kind of just jokingly said? Well, there's a reason why he didn't run. I said, you know, why didn't he, you know, sort of jokingly, but there really is a reason that he didn't run, and that is that running would not have done him any good. Ashurbanipal, whenever he got in his head to get somebody, he tended to get them. And here's some of the things that Ashurbanipal is famous for having said and done. Before we progress any further, I'd like to shed a little light on why maybe his brother felt like immolating himself was a better idea. So, according to an account translated by Albert Kirk Grayson from the Assyrian royal script inscriptions that are held in Britain, This is an account given by Ashurbanipal himself, and this is a story, I guess, being told between him and a commander. He proudly recalls his punishment and records it. He says, upon taking a city who resisted his rule, I flayed as many nobles as had rebelled against me and draped their skins over the pile of corpses. Some I spread out within the pile, and some I erected on stakes upon the pile. I flayed many right through my land and draped their skins over the wall. This is probably intended not only to let people know that Ashurbanipal wasn't playing around, but also to frighten anybody else who might dare resist, and to suppress his enemies was the king's divine task, supported by the gods. He always had to be victorious in battle and to punish disobedient people. So, here's a couple other descriptions from Ashurbanipal to the people that he's conquered and the people that he's going to conquer. In one account, he says that I felled 50 other fighting men with the sword, burnt 200 captives from them, and defeated in battle on the plain 332 troops. With their blood, I dyed the mountain red like wool, and the rest of them, the ravines and torrents of the mountain, swallowed. I carried off captives and possessions from them. I cut off the heads of their fighters and built therewith a tower before their city. I burnt their adolescent boys and girls. A description of one of his other conquests is a little bit worse. He says, in strife and in conflict, I besieged and conquered the city. I felled 3,000 of their fighting men with the sword. I captured many of their troops alive. For some of them, I cut off some of their arms and hands. Others, I cut off of their noses, ears, and extremities. To some men, I gouged out the eyes, and I made one pile of the living and one of heads. I hung their heads on trees around the city so as to make the message ring loud and clear. So these are rough translations of some of the things that Ashurbanipal was pretty well known for doing. And this is probably what his brother had come to expect was going to happen to him for rebelling. These are some of the things that he did to people in Nimrud, in nearby cities that he had conquered, and they had said, you know, they waited till he left, basically, and then tried to overthrow him. So this is what he did when that happened. He tended to go back and make an example out of people. So when we look at Ashurbanipal's brother and say, oh, well, you know, burn yourself alive is kind of stupid. Yeah, well, getting your skin peeled off while you're still alive or having and watching your family be dismembered in front of you is probably a lot less fun than just burning yourself alive. back on track now. After the first campaign against Elam, there's a second campaign. Now, after he retakes Babylon, and his brother, wisely kills himself before he can fall into the hands of Ashurbanipal, Elam erupts into civil war. Elam had died, and now different factions fought for his throne, and Ashurbanipal, being the smart guy that he was, saw an opportunity to finally defeat his old enemy and drove his army again into Elam. Now, one historian, Susan Weiss Bauer, writes, Elamite cities burned. The temples and palaces of Susa were robbed for no better reason than vengeance. Ashurbanipal ordered the royal tombs opened and the bones of the kings bundled off into captivity. When he sacked and destroyed the city of Susa in the year 647 BCE, he left behind a tablet which recorded his triumph over the Elamites. It said, and it is written, Susa, the great holy city, abode of their gods, seat of their mysteries, I conquered. I entered its palaces. I opened their treasuries where silver and gold and goods and wealth were amassed. I destroyed the ziggurat of Susa. I smashed its shining copper horns. I reduced the temples of Elam to naught. Their gods and goddesses I scattered to the winds. The tombs of their ancient and recent kings I devastated. I exposed to the sun, and I carried away their bones toward the land of Ashur. I devastated the provinces of Elam, and on their lands I sowed salt. Now, for those of you unfamiliar with the sowing of salt, it's probably one of the most harsh things that you can do. Sowing salt in the land was to make sure that the land was no longer fertile. It was thought by salting the land, you wouldn't be able to grow things. And who knew? You really wouldn't be able to grow things depending on the soil that you're dealing with. So sowing salt really was sort of the early days scorched earth policy. Basically, we're going to kill everybody that we can. We're going to take everything of value. And then when that's all gone and that's all done and we've gotten bored of that, we're just going to leave nothing behind but ashes. We're going to leave you with no way possible to recover. And that was the reason that they sowed salt in the land back in these times. And you see it still done in the Middle Ages at times. People sowed salt into people's land so that it would not be fertile anymore. So this is one of those things where you really had to have some serious disdain for somebody if you were going to do something like that. So Ashur Banipal, clearly not a fan of these individuals. Now, in addition to conquering Elam and sowing salt outside their capital, anyone with even the slightest claim to the throne was captured and brought back to Nineveh as a slave. In keeping with Assyrian policy, Ashurbanipal then relocated enormous numbers of the population throughout the region and left the cities empty and the fields barren. The historian Bauer writes, Ashurbanipal did not rebuild after the wrecking of the country. He installed no governors. He resettled none of the devastated cities. He made no attempt to make this new province of Assyria anything more than a wasteland. Elam lay open and undefended, which apparently later proves to be a mistake as the Persians begin to creep in there and rebuild and fortify these cities. But that's for later. We'll get to that later. Now, before we proceed further into some of the more military, military accomplishments and some of the other accomplishments of Ashurbanipal, because he had a great many accomplishments outside military achievement. He was also a scholarly king, so we'll get into that as well. He was a man who believed in the preservation of knowledge, at least knowledge that he thought was important. But before we get to that, we're going to take a brief commercial break. And I'd like to remind you all that here at Totally Driven Entertainment, we do have a proud new sponsor. He's funny, he's wacky, and he's crazy. Check out ChrisFraleyPresents.com for some uplifting content, a little bit less negative than what I get to cover here sometimes, but a little bit more uplifting, a little bit more comedic. After the commercial break, we're going to get into some more of the specifics of Ashurbanipal's military achievements, his conquests, and of course, we'll talk about his non-military achievements. We'll get into some of the more outlandish and cruel things as well that Ashurbanipal is said to have done.
I'm Black Man, saving man's eye, one stereotype at a time.
To the Black Barbarian. To the corner of Martin Luther King Street and Malcolm X Boulevard, pronto.
Will Black Man make it to the crime on time? Or will he be on CPT? Stay tuned at ChrisFraleyPresents.com.
Attention business owners, website owners, event promoters, or anyone looking to promote your product. The Totally Driven Entertainment Radio Network is the perfect way to spread the word of your business around the world. That's right, you can advertise at our network and be played on all of our shows at rates that are so cheap, it's a no-brainer. For more information, contact Bay Ragney at bayragney@gmail.com. To keep your business driven, stay driven with Totally Driven Entertainment.
Are you a fan of Sherlock Holmes? Letters from Holmes offers unique, one-of-a-kind letters from the world-famous detective himself. Handwritten on 8.5-inch by 11-inch aged parchment paper and using smudge-free ink to produce original, high-quality letters that fans will treasure for years to come. Each letter is handcrafted and written from the perspective of Sherlock Holmes, mimicking Holmes's native tongue and embracing many of the famous detective's quirks, quips, insults, and peculiarities. Order a love letter, birthday greeting, personal correspondence, or more only at www.etsy.com/shop/lettersfromhomes.
For $5 today, you can buy a wealth of things. Gas for your car, rent a movie for the family, a few slices of pizza. $5 still takes you a long ways. But did you know that $5 can buy your child a bag of heroin in the streets? That's right. For only $5, your son or daughter can buy some of the cheapest and purest dope in the country. Be aware of the lies. Be aware of the stealing. Be aware that's all it takes to kill your child. $5. This message was brought to you by Casey's Cause, a group of parents located in southern Chester County out to save your child's life. Come join us today at www.caseyscause.com. And remember, $5 is all it takes. Casey's Cause, www.caseyscause.com.
Looking for that perfect gift for your girlfriend? Then look no further than Teddy Scares. Teddy Scares are available in a variety of styles, sizes, and prices for all your shopping needs. Teddy Scares are a mix of cute and creepy to make a great gift for almost any age. Board up your windows, lock your doors, and log on to TeddyScares.com. And be sure to become our friends at Facebook.com/TeddyScares.
Calling all comic book fans. Do you collect comics? Did you ever collect comics? Do you think your children might like reading comic books? Do you even know they still print real, paper, non-digital comic books? Well, then visit the Pirates of Ontario Street Comics in Philadelphia. We have a massive collection of comic books, action figures, trading cards, and much more. We have one of the largest stocks of back-issue comics in the area. We bag and board every new comic book at no extra charge. Our store is voted the best comic book shop in the 2013 PHL 17 Hot List Contest. Part of the movie Unbreakable is filmed in our store. We are open 7 days a week. Ontario Street Comics is located at 2235 East Ontario Street in the Port Richmond section of Philly. Our phone number is 215-288-7338. Type in the words Ontario Comics Philadelphia to check out our wacky stores page on Facebook.
Welcome back to all my lovely, lovely fans. Those of you listening in, I appreciate you guys always listening in. Now, guys, I want to remind you all that there is a call-in number, 718-508-9883. And for those of you who've been listening in, you know we've been talking about Ashurbanipal, the mighty Assyrian king. Now, before the break, I talked about some of his military campaigns and how he dealt with those people who rebelled against him a little bit. Despite being a rather popular king amongst his subjects, he was known for his cruelty to his enemies. There are some pictures depicting him putting a dog chain through the jaw of a defeated Arab king and then making him live as his pet in a dog kennel. Many paintings of the period exhibit his brutality. However, it should be noted that Assyrian harshness was reserved solely for those who took up arms against the Assyrian king, and neither Ashurbanipal nor his predecessors conducted genocides, massacres, or ethnic cleansings against civilian populations, or at least those who didn't resist against him. Now, Ashurbanipal inherited his kingdom, as I mentioned before, from Ashurhaddon, but also not only did he inherit his father's kingdom, he also inherited his war with Egypt and the Nubians, or the Kushites. He ended the Egyptian interference in the Near East. He destroyed the Kushite Empire. He drove them from Egypt and conquered Egypt and Libya. Despite that, the Nubians still had ambitions to regain control of Egypt and resurrect their empire. He defeated the Nubian king near Memphis. I mentioned that as well. He also defeated those individuals who rebelled against him, namely Semetichus, who foolishly rebelled against him despite the fact that he was granted a kingship. He defeated Elam. And eventually taking over the kingdom of Babylon and becoming a bit of a pain in the rear. Now, after after his brother and he had sorted out their issues, namely by his brother committing suicide, there wasn't really a whole lot for him to do except kind of sit back on his laurels. For the final two decades of Ashurbanipal's rule, Assyria was peaceful, and its dominance went for pretty much unchallenged. The country, however, apparently faced an underlying decline due to overexpansion, the lack of funds from its devastated colonies, and insufficient troops to govern its vast empire. Documentation from the last years of his reign is scarce. The last attestations of Ashurbanipal's reign are of his year 38, which would be 631 BC, but according to the Greek historian Castor, he reigned for 42 years until the year 627 BC. Now, after his death, circa 627 BC, he is succeeded by Ashur-etil-ilani, who reigns for 3 years, but soon after, Assyria descends into a series of internal civil wars that ultimately lead to its downfall with the arrival and the rise of the Persian Empire, who had taken up residence in what was once Elam and begun to expand outward. Now, Ashurbanipal was known for his many military achievements. I mentioned his conquering of Egypt, the Kushites, Elam, the putting down of rebellions, his expansions in Anatolia and Libya. But Ashurbanipal was proud more so of his intellectual achievements. I mentioned before he's very educated. He's incredibly proud of his scribal education. He asserts this in a statement that I, Ashurbanipal, within the palace, took care of the wisdom of Nebo, the whole of the inscribed tablets, of all the clay tablets, the whole of their mysteries and difficulties I solved. He was one of the few kings who could read the cuneiform script in Akkadian and Sumerian and claimed that he could even read texts from before the Great Flood. He was also able to solve mathematical problems. During his reign, he collected cuneiform texts from all over Mesopotamia, especially in Babylon, in his royal library at Nineveh, the Assyrian capital. He commissioned copies of literary works from libraries around the kingdom in order to obtain the hidden treasures of the scribe's knowledge, as he called it. And the results were stored in what became now known as the Library of Ashurbanipal, pieces of which still exist today. Now, Nineveh is destroyed in 612 BC, but many of the library's clay tablets survived the devastation. His palace was excavated in December of 1853, and the surviving contents of the library were rediscovered. Over 30,000 clay tablets and fragments were uncovered in the library, providing archaeologists with a wealth of Mesopotamian literary, religious, and administrative work from the time. The library included hymns, prayers, medical and mathematical, ritual, divinatory, and astrological texts, alongside all sorts of administrative documents, letters, and contracts. Other genres found during excavations include standard lists used by scribes and scholars, word lists, bilingual vocabularies, lists of signs and synonyms, lists of medical diagnoses, astronomic and astrological texts. As well, the scribal text proved to be incredibly helpful in deciphering cuneiform. So Ashurbanipal is considered by some library scholars as an archetypal librarian in that his library set the course for how the libraries of today operate. While the library at Nineveh was utilized by a select elite and, of course, Ashurbanipal himself, the basic purposes of the library and the services provided are similar to those seen in modern academic libraries today. Now, following the destruction of Elam, the very idea that the empire would not last forever would have been considered to be absurd. There was no rival or near rival to the might of the Assyrians at that time, and the Assyrians' ancient enemies of Urartu and Elam were both defeated, and even though Egypt had broken free, it had been stamped with Assyrian culture. Among the works found in the library of Ashurbanipal were the Enuma Elish, the Babylonian epic of creation, the great tale, epic tale of Gilgamesh, the oldest adventure story extant. It was among the tablets of Nineveh that the original Mesopotamian story of the Great Flood, which predates the story in the Bible, was found in the 19th century when they did those excavations. The library discovery has since been considered one of the greatest and most important archaeological finds in history, further solidifying that Ashurbanipal might be one of history's greatest leaders, in that he preserved so much of his culture from that time. It was incredibly impressive that he was able to amass such a wealth of knowledge in such a short period of time, and that it was stored in a place where it was able to survive the test of time. Keep in mind that this was over 2,000 years ago, and these things still exist. This is incredibly impressive. Ashurbanipal claimed to be able to read cuneiform script in both Akkadian and Sumerian, and his collections of writings were vast. According to the historian Paul Kririzek, Ashurbanipal went further than mere ability to read and claimed complete mastery of all the scribal arts. In his own words, I mentioned before that he had said that he had come to understand the wisdom of Nabu. Nabu was the god of learning. He claimed that all the art of writing of every kind he knew. I made myself the master of them all. I read the cunning tablets of Sumer and the dark Akkadian language, which is difficult to rightly use. I took my pleasure in reading stones inscribed before the flood, the best of the scribal arts, such works as none of the kings who went before me had ever learnt. Remedies from the top of the head to the toenails, non-canonical selections, clever teachings, whatever pertains to the medical mastery of the gods Ninurta and Gala, I wrote on the tablets, checked and collated and deposited within my palace for perusing and reading. So Ashurbanipal dedicated himself to basically every form of learning that existed during this time. He dedicated himself to basically just researching and learning. Kririzek further notes that this is no idle boast of the king, as there's actual proof that Ashurbanipal could compose in cuneiform and cites tablets which are signed by Ashurbanipal, the king of Assyria. In collecting his famous library, he wrote to cities and centers of learning all across Mesopotamia, instructing them to send him copies of every written work ever set down in the entire region. He was concerned not to just amass as large a collection as possible, but to ensure that he had copies of every important work in the Mesopotamian canon. In the letter to the governor of Borsippa, he goes on to list prayers, incantations, and other texts identified, as was usual in ancient times, by their first words. Size and scope of his library at Nineveh is testimony to how successful he was in collecting the works he requested from his subjects. The historian Bauer writes, as far as Ashurbanipal was concerned, his library was the abiding accomplishment of his reign. He says, I, Ashurbanipal, king of the universe, on whom the gods have bestowed intelligence, who has acquired penetrating acumen for the most recondite details of scholarly erudition, none of my predecessors having any comprehension of such matters, I have placed these tablets for the future in the library at Nineveh for my life and for the well-being of my soul to sustain the foundations of my royal name. Esarhaddon might have managed to keep Egypt, but Ashurbanipal's realm of the mind shall last forever. So Ashurbanipal thought pretty highly of himself, and he was a guy that accomplished a great deal in his short lifespan here. In between collecting his library, renovating Nineveh, and running the empire, Ashurbanipal continued to lead his own military campaigns. He also oversaw renovations at Babylon, but by the year 629 BC, he was in ill health and left Nineveh for the city of Haran to the north. He left the empire in the hands of his son, Ashur-et-El-Ilani, but this decision was challenged by the new king's twin brother, Sin-Shikar-Ishkun, and a civil war erupted as a consequence. The territories of the Assyrian Empire would take advantage of this division and began to exercise more autonomy than they had been allowed previously. Ashurbanipal died 2 years later in 627 BC, and the empire broke apart. As the historian Bauer writes, disorder swallowed almost every part of the empire as formal vassal states declared their independence. Between 627 and 612 BC, the empire steadily dissolved as Medes, Persians, Babylonians, Sumerians, Scythians, and Chaldeans burned and sacked the Assyrian cities. In the year 612, Ashur, Kalhu, and Nineveh are destroyed in the great conflagrations which swept the land. Ashurbanipal's library is buried beneath the burning walls of his palace and is lost to history, for over 2,000 years. Their discovery, though, changed the way people in the modern day understood culture and the past. And prior to the discovery of Ashurbanipal's library, the Bible was considered to be the oldest book in the world, and the stories contained were thought to have no precedent. But as excavations in the 19th century by Sir Austin Henry Layard, Hormozd Rossum, and translations made by George Smith brought to light a world which no one up until that time were aware of. Ashurbanipal's empire fell, and the territories it conquered went on to be conquered by others, and then by still others. But his library endured, and as he claimed himself, turned out to be his greatest accomplishment. Guys, that's all I've got for you today on Ashurbanipal. This guy was a fascinating individual, a man who kind of killed guy, despite being pretty cruel to his enemies. He was pretty even keeled with his subjects, and he dedicated himself to bettering himself and bettering those around him in the way that he best thought he was able to, which was by acquiring as much knowledge as possible and using that knowledge form a better understanding of the world in which he was in, and also to spread and preserve that knowledge for future generations. So even though Ashurbanipal was a particularly cruel king when you're on the opposing side, it seems that he ruled pretty fairly, pretty justly for the majority of his time, and he does have a 20-year period in which his empire is completely at peace with the removal of Elam, the subjugation of Egypt and the Kushites, and the subjugation of Babylon. Things are pretty peaceful. It's only his lack of all to see that not fully subjugating Elam, that sowing the land instead of with salt instead of just conquering it and taxing it and holding on to it and subjugating the people to be his puppet state, that really came to bite him in the rear and allowed the Persians to sort of get close enough to get his enemies all hyped up enough to beat his empire down. In his later years, though, it seems that Ashurbanipal was less concerned with ruling his kingdom and more concerned with stockpiling knowledge and informing himself about the universe. Nonetheless, he's probably made one of the single greatest contributions to mankind that any person can make, in that he preserved basically not only all of his own kingdom's culture, but also the languages, the cultures, the writings, the stories, the religious ideas, the sciences of his period, basically everything, the essence of that time period. He captured it and he preserved it for future generations. And he did such a good job of this. His collection was so vast and it was so well protected that it lasted for another 2,500 years plus. So this guy was truly a remarkable individual. And if you're interested in learning more about Ashurbanipal, which I recommend you guys take a look at his work, I would recommend that you check out www.ancient.eu and look up Ashurbanipal. There's a great article written there by Joshua J. Mark. A lot of good source material to go take a look at within it from other historians who've done work on this guy. This is a really well put together article, really well summarized. And you look at, when you look at this guy's achievements as a whole, this is a pretty impressive individual. You'll definitely want to take a look at the chronology of the reign of Ashurbanipal by A.K. Grayson, S.W. Bowers, The History of the Ancient World. You'll want to take a look at P. Krizek's Babylon. You can take a look at Like's Mesopotamia. And finally, W. von Soden's The Ancient Orient. All of these would be a great look for you. If you're looking for ancient history, take a look at Ancient History Encyclopedia online. It's a great starting point for those of you who are looking to get more in touch with ancient history and sources involving earlier peoples, pre-Rome, pre society, pre-Hellenistic period, because it's a difficult period in which to tap into. There are scant resources for a lot of people that existed during that time, simply because a lot of stuff gets lost, a lot of things get destroyed, and not everybody is a good custodian of their culture like Ashurbanipal. So I goes, guys, I hope you enjoyed the show today. I hope you learned a lot. I hope you found it interesting. I know Ashurbanipal, maybe not as cruel as King Leopold, but really I think that's kind of a good thing. Cruel to his enemies, kind to his subjects, a man of learning, a man of enlightenment for his time, to say the least, and a man who made a massive contribution to the human race. So hope you guys enjoyed the show. You can catch me live on Sunday, and hopefully I'll sound a lot better Sunday morning at 9 a.m. Eastern Time. We're going to be talking to Derek Martin and Jonathan Wells on Straight Football Talk at 9 a.m. Eastern on Sunday. It's going to be a good time. I'm very excited about it. Excuse me. Too excited about it, apparently. But I'm very excited about the show. Should be a great time. We're going to be talking about the playoffs. If your team is in, congratulations, your team has made it. We're going to be talking about your team's chances moving forward on Sunday. And if your team didn't make it, that's okay. They're still next year, and you can still root against the team you don't like if they're in the playoffs. So that's all I've got for you guys today. I appreciate all of you who have continued to tune in. Thanks for tuning into the Bareback Facts, and I'll be back next week with a fresh set of episodes for you all. Please enjoy the rest of your weekend. Stay safe out there, those of you who are in that nasty weather like me. And we'll see you all on Sunday.